I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Matt Smith.
And we are historians.
No, I'm not.
And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, you're right. We are addicted to the archives.
So welcome to Season 6 of Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, where they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? No?
It's great. Okay. Loving it.
All right.
I just like, I didn't realise your voice sounds so different.
Okay. Today on the podcast, we meet in the pod booth at La Trobe University on unceded Wurundjeri land. I'm normally the producer, but today I've come out behind the microphone. I've asked Eve and Claire to budge up on the Archive Fever sofa because today's guest is none other than regular co-host Claire Wright.
Hello.
Hey, Claire.
I'm here. I'm just on the other side of the desk and it feels very strange.
Claire Wright is an award-winning historian, author, broadcaster and public commentator who is a professor of history and professor of public engagement at La Trobe University. Her books, Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, Australia's Female Publicans, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, and You Daughters of Freedom are all bestsellers, with Forgotten Rebels in particular picking up the 2014 Stella Prize and the NIB Literary Award and People's Choice Award, and nominated for many others. If that's not impressive enough, her newly released book... If that's not impressive enough, her newly released book says Hold My Flag to all her earlier works... Naku Daruk, The Bark Petitions, tells the story of a pivotal document of Australia's democracy story, which should be much better known than it is. Welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Thank you very much.
Claire, we usually start our podcast by asking, how did you first get bitten by the research bug? As an Archive Fever veteran for the last six series, if you go back to episode one, you can hear Claire talk about that. So let's talk about this a little bit differently. How has six series of Archive Fever make you reconsider how you look at archives?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually, Matt. I think what the last 6 years has done, both in Eve and I curating the panel of guests that we get for each season and then listening to those guests speak, has really broadened my idea of what the archive is. I reckon we went into this series, certainly I went into this podcast with the idea that archives essentially were places that were bricks and mortar buildings that you went and sat behind a desk, sharpened your pencil, got out some papers and flicked through them and looked at words and drew your own words out of them. It's been really eye-opening for me and mind-expanding and heart-opening for me to appreciate that conception of the archive is essentially a Western Enlightenment colonial idea of the archive, and to accept that there are so many ways in which knowledge is embedded and transferred and communicated, and that that is all archive when you are thinking about an archive as being some kind of record of knowledge and knowledge transfer. So the episodes that we've done on the night sky as an archive, or the land as archive, or ice as archive, or the body as archive. Each one of them has pushed me conceptually and intellectually to understand the richness of what we mean by where we go to find the answers to the questions that we pose. And essentially, that's what the archive is. You put out a research question in one way or another, some form of critical inquiry, and then in searching for answers, you go to the archive. And I just have such a broader idea of where one might go to find answers to questions now.
Mm. One thing that I've really enjoyed about producing this podcast over the years is when you get a guest in the guest chair who is completely confused as to why they are there, and they will say to you, no, I don't have any engagement with the archive. I don't deal with the archive. And by the end of the interview, they're going, no, I engage in the archive all the time. It's just not what I think of as an archive. So yeah, you educate that, your guests as well sometimes.
Yeah, the episode that strikes me as being most in that vein is Helen Garner, who was very reluctant to see herself as in any way as an archivist or invested in archives. And, yeah, absolutely, by the end of that wonderful episode, she was absolutely invested in the idea that she both created archive and used archive, and that she self-archived. And she's actually subsequently sent me a couple of notes thanking Eve and I for interviewing her, because now she realises that so much of what the work that she does on a daily basis is archival.
So can you tell us about the Bark Petitions then? This book has been called the third book in your Democracy series, which I think insinuates that there's not going to be any others. So I think you should give yourself an out there in case.
It's called the third book in my Democracy trilogy.
Yes.
So
yes,
that implies absolutely that it's not going to become a quartet.
Douglas Adams would say otherwise to that sort of number counting. Why is this an important part of Australia's democracy that you think needed to be told? And what are the Bark Petitions and how do they tie into that?
Okay. The Bark Petitions were these extraordinary documents, paper petitions written in Yolngu-Mata and in English and pasted onto bark frames that were painted with traditional Yolngu designs, presented to the Parliament in August 1963, protesting against the incursion of mining on their lands, not protesting against mining per se, but protesting against the lack of consultation that had happened. The Menzies government had excised a portion of the Arnhem Land Reserve in order to give mining licences, and they had done that without informing, let alone consulting Yolngu people. And when this was found out, the Methodist superintendent, the Reverend Edgar Wells, blew the whistle on this, and it became a national issue because civil rights groups, particularly in Melbourne, got involved and started to get some Labor politicians, opposition politicians. This is the rule of the Menzies government at the time. So these petitions were a combination of a kind of colonial literacy, but also very much asking for a voice and expressing through that voice that Yolngu people had complete sovereignty over their land, had never ceded sovereignty, had never considered that any other people owned the land other than them. They had been trading with Makassan fishermen from Sulawesi in present-day Indonesia for centuries. Makassans had been coming onto the land every year, harvesting tripang. But all of that had happened along the lines of Yolngu law and Yolngu sovereignty. The Makassans had respected Yolngu law about asking permission to come onto country, not only asking permission to take resources, but compensating in some way for resources taken. So the Yolngu had every reason in a kind of governance and trade relations to believe that they were a sovereign nation. This was the first time in 1963 that they started to think otherwise, or were started to get the hint that maybe others thought otherwise. So really the petitions were a way of negotiating from one nation to another, from the Yolngu nation to the Australian nation, a form of treaty or agreement making that would respect the needs of both sides. Unfortunately, the first petition was rejected by the Parliament. The second one was accepted. And on the back of that, a select inquiry was commissioned to look into the grievances of the Yirrkala people. And that's the first time that any petition has been put to an Australian Parliament that led to a parliamentary inquiry. Now, where this fits into my democracy trilogy is about that question of voice. So each of the books, the Eureka book, the suffrage book, and now this one, turns on a material object that was made by people on the ground to say, we are here. Our voices must be counted. We must be heard. And that, when it boils down to it, is the essence of democracy. Government for the people, by the people. The people require a voice. What each of these moments in Australian history demonstrate is a time in which that idea of who the people were was expanded.
Mm.
So in the Gold Rush times in Eureka, that expanded to include working men, not just landed gentry, who were able to vote. The franchise was given to them. Women fought for those rights, for men, and for a time for women as well. But women were essentially thrown under the bus when men got those world-leading franchise rights. Come the next great nation-building moment after the gold rushes was Federation, and women said there, we will not be forsaken again. We will help fight for this democratic nation, but our voices must be heard. And that story is effectively told by the women's suffrage banner that hangs in Parliament House, and that's what that second book tells. But the very same Act of Parliament that granted women those world-leading rights only granted them to white women.
Mm.
And all Indigenous people lost any federal franchise, and it was not until the 1960s. In 1962, they won voting rights, and as we know, it was not until 1967 that the referendum counted Indigenous people in the census for the first time. This story sits right in there as this pivotal moment in which First Nations people raised their voice and asked it to be heard. So I think that's where the trilogy turns on both the material heritage of Australian democracy, this very handmade, ground-up democracy, but it really turns on the idea of voice.
So let's talk about your research experience now. Tell us about researching Indigenous histories. What archives are available to you, and what is your connection to them?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, that gets me directly onto this book, which is why I'm in the chair today. Mm. This book is just being published. It's been the book that I've been working on for the last 10 years. So certainly all of the series of Archive Fever that we've done, this book has been bubbling away in the background for it. And it's a departure for me in the sense that I am not known for working in the field of Aboriginal history. I've never published in the journal Aboriginal History. I would not consider myself an expert in any way in Aboriginal history, but this particular book came to me in a way. I didn't go to it seeking it out. I feel very much like it's a story that found me. I know that's kind of wanky to say that, but it had to do with having already been embedded in Yolngu community in northeast Arnhem Land as a community member through a completely different trajectory that had nothing to do with my work, that took me and my family to northeast Arnhem Land in 2010. And it was through that community engagement that I started to learn something more about this story. And in particular, I started to learn that this is a story that the Yolngu people wanted to have told, didn't feel was well recognised enough. When they found out that I was an historian and I had these kinds of research skills, were very keen on me being involved in bringing this story to light. So what's been such a joy about the research process, and I would really love to write a companion volume to this book, which lays out in a narrative kind of sense the research process, a bit like Kate Grenville's Searching for the Secret River that she wrote after The Secret River.
Mm.
Because it's just been such an extraordinary journey. Things have fallen into my lap. I've had extraordinary finds. I've met people who I thought were dead. Oh my God, this is going to sound even wankier. But it's almost like the research for this book was blessed by the universe.
Mm.
I had so many universe moments. So really what's happened with this research has been a combination of that traditional archival, colonial archive research, months in the National Archives in Canberra, months in the National Library, at IATSIS in their paper files, in state libraries around the country. But I've also done oral history interviews with participants who were in Yirrkala in 1963, which is when this story plays out, and those are living white descendants and participants. But then I've had this special access to the Yolngu community as well. So that has meant a lot of time just sitting and listening and talking and asking questions. The research has been specific in that I ask questions directly about the story of the Yirrkala Bark petitions. But the research has also been much more general or diffuse, which has just been about being there, about being on country, about being in community, about feeling and experiencing on really a very bodily level what it's like to live in Northeast Arnhem Land. And over the course of 15 years of me going backwards and forwards, I feel like what I was able to do with this book is to have that really sensorial experience play out in the narrative. I hope, and people have told me since reading it, that it feels like being there. Somebody texted me the other day and said, you can smell the red dirt.
Mm.
You can feel the humidity wrapping itself around your shoulders like a shawl. Because I've actually been able to be there in place on country, unlike, say, the Eureka book, where, yeah, I can go to Ballarat, but I can't be in Ballarat in 1854. And in the suffrage book, yeah, I can go to London, but I can't be in London in 1908. I can recreate a sense of being there through the archives, but this book much more felt like that sense of recreation of place was based on my own physical experience of country.
Mm.
Claire, you said a moment ago that doing this podcast has broadened your view of the archive and taught you to see it as many things outside the kind of bricks and mortar Western archive. And you can really see that in this book, I think, in Naku Daruk. You really draw upon Yungul storytelling as an archive, Yungul relationship to country. I think more than any other history book I've read by a white settler historian, it really does incorporate Yungul ways of knowing and being, or First Nations ways of knowing and being. Was that kind of a conscious part of what you set out to do in writing this book, to kind of draw upon and incorporate Western epistemology and knowledge systems and archives and Yungul, or did that just kind of how it organically emerge?
I think it's a bit of both.
Mm.
I think that by the time I came to writing the book, so the way that my process works, I've never been one of those write early and write often people. I do all my research and then I very painfully pull up stumps on research and then I procrastinate in as many ways as I can before I actually...
That's the germination phase, surely.
It's something. I mean, it is part of the process and you have to trust your process. So, you know, the house is clean for a while as I'm procrastinating starting writing. But once I eventually sat down and started to write this and was thinking about it structurally, I think that's when the combination of planning and organically feeling my way into it came together. Because one of the things that I knew that I wanted to do was to write the book in a way that its predominantly Western readers would be able to understand and respond to the narrative. So a familiar form of storytelling, which is essentially chronological, the idea of a beginning, middle, and an end that a story has, but also knowing from the amount of time that I had spent with Yungul people and listened to their storytelling that their storytelling generally does not work in a straight line. It is not teleological. It spirals. And reading the book Song Spirals by the Gaywu group of women, who are a group of sisters from Northeast Arnhem Land and some white academics who they collaborate with. Reading that book, Song Spirals, was really my way of matching what I had experienced by being around people and storytelling with an intellectual conceptualization of that idea of the song spiral. So I tried to interweave Yungul timeframes and temporality, that idea of the everywhen, that there's a present and a past and a future embedded in every moment, that you can't actually separate those things. So I tried to sort of intercut that into the more traditional chronological narrative. And the way I actually came at doing that was not through Yungul epistemology, it was actually through Joan Didion. And Joan Didion's idea of jump cuts, which is also a very filmic way of viewing things. So flashbacks, moments, little times out of time, and that sort of undercut the sequencing in a way. And that was what gave me the idea that that's where I could intersperse the kind of Yolngu epistemology and the Yolngu storytelling techniques, and I could scatter that through. And what I hoped would come out of it, and tell me as a reader whether you think it has, was both to follow the Western epistemological idea of progressive linear time, but also fuck with it at the same time.
I think you've absolutely succeeded. You know, we're very, as a reader, oriented along the trajectory of, you know, the book follows the events of 1963, but we do have these little jump cuts which take us back into deep time and emphasise this ocean of every when. And I have to tell you, Claire, I was in a class with honours students yesterday and we were talking about archives and decolonising archives and bringing in First Nations ways of knowing and coming from kind of oral storytelling traditions. And one of my students said, but are we allowed to include that kind of evidence in a, you know, historical writing? Will we get in trouble? Are we allowed to do it? And I said, well, look. And I went to my office and I came back with Naku Daruk and I said, look, Professor Claire Wright, OAM, is doing this already. So if she can do it, I think you as an honours student definitely can. So I want to pay tribute to what you've done, Claire, but also acknowledge that there's a kind of permission giving you are giving to the next generation to explore with engaging with knowledge and archives and storytelling in different ways, in ways that are both engaging for the reader but help us decolonise the way we think about history and time and story on this continent.
That's really interesting, Eve. And what it's making me think about is other episodes of this podcast that we've done where we've discussed the idea of queering the archive and that also is a way of making that teleological timeline not as straight, bending the arrow of that time. And we've talked about that in terms of it's not necessarily an undermining, but it's a broadening, it's an expanding notions of what you know and how you know it. And then I guess what you're also saying is then it expands our idea of how you then can communicate that as well.
Absolutely.
So can you tell us a bit about your process then and how extensively you wanted to integrate the Indigenous voice into this work and make sure that you properly convey how they believe the events unfolded and how their archives recorded how the events unfolded and what that meant to your writing process?
Yeah, well, this is a tricky one methodologically because, as you know, I'm a white woman from Melbourne, and the idea that I could inhabit the voice or the heads of Yolngu people from Northeast Arnhem Land is problematic in all sorts of ways. In a way that I don't have with inhabiting other characters, because what I do in the way that I write, and because this is narrative nonfiction, I write on the heels of my characters, and I almost write in their voice in a way. So whether that is Paul Hasluck, the Minister for Territories, or whether that is Gordon Bryant, the Labor MP for the seat of Wills, who was so integral to the story, or whether that's Beth Graham or Ron Croxford, teachers, Methodist teachers in Yirrkala in 1963, I write from their perspective, not in the first person, but I write as if they are seeing the story playing out. And I do that from the archive. I don't make up words for them, but I create, in a sense, a kind of dialogue or an internal monologue that is utterly archivally based.
Close third, as I believe they say in literary worlds.
Oh, close third.
So close third person. Oh, so like you're not writing in first person, but the third person is kind of narrator, is veering towards inhabiting their consciousness.
So yes, close third, that's what I do. And I do it with the intention of making sure that if the characters in the story don't know what happens next, we don't know what happens next either. And that keeps it very grounded in a kind of present, even if you're writing in the past tense. And I think that that keeps the storytelling truer to the way that people live and experience their lives. You don't know what's going to happen after we leave the studio today, Matt. You don't know what path you're going to take, Eve. You might have plans for what's going to happen this afternoon, but those plans might go awry in some kind of way because something might intervene. You don't know that's going to happen, but when we're telling the story of this day, from hindsight, it gives it this sort of omniscient narrator's idea, that a sense of inevitability about the fact that your day, you were going to do this, but then you did that. I want to ground it back in the headspace of, I'm going about my day, I'm making choices, and these are the things that I think might be the effects of my choices, but I don't really know that. There's no inevitability. And that, I think, gives the sort of intimacy to the character development. I think we feel more closely aligned with those people because we're invested in their psychological state in some kind of way. To get back to your original question, Matt, I found that harder to do for Yolngu people, more problematic ethically. Although one of the people who I worked most closely with on this project was the man whose family adopted me, and he's passed away last year, but I've been given permission by the family to use his name in speaking about the book. And so that was Galarrwuy Yunupingu, and his fourth wife was the woman who adopted me when we first moved to Northeast Arnhem Land in 2010. And so it was Galarrwuy's household I lived in, his children became my children, and it was Galarrwuy who first essentially asked me to do this project and work with him. And I did a series of interviews with Galarrwuy in 2021. I managed to escape between Melbourne lockdowns and spend 2 months in Arnhem Land. And every day we'd sit down for an hour together, recording on my phone what he called Ngarraku Dawu Land Rights Boy, meaning my land rights story. He was confined to a chair or a wheelchair, and so I'd go and I'd sit with him. And very much creating archive, I must say. Like, that is, you know, it's an extraordinary series of interviews that I now have with him, intimate to the extreme, sitting in the lounge room, life going on. But I remember asking him at one stage, how do I know what is the beginning, what is the middle, and what is the end? And he said, you have to put yourself into the minds of the men who painted the bark petitions. And I said, but how do I do that? How do I put myself in the minds of old Yolngu men from Northeast Arnhem Land in the 1960s when I'm an old, I'm the same age as them, they're called elders, but I would be the same age if not older than them, white woman from the southern states of Australia living now? And he said, you just have to look for the clues. You have to look for the clues. And in, so in a sense, he gave me permission. I think it's not to think your way into what people are experiencing, but to imagine your way into it. It's actually much more about empathy or affect. But then at the same time, I didn't make anything up because I'm an historian, not a novelist. So nothing's made up. It's all based on the things that Yolngu people told me from either eyewitnesses or from memories they had as being children and the stories that were passed down to them about things happening. There was no Yolngu written record. A written Yolngu script was only invented by a Methodist missionary up there in the 1950s. So nobody really wrote Yolngu mata except the missionaries. We're not talking here about first-person documentary accounts by Yolngu people, but all of that is storytelling.
In 1963, First Nations people asked for their voice to be heard, and they were not fully heeded. In 2023, First Nations people also asked for a voice to Parliament and were not heeded. This book, Ngarraku Dawu, has been published on the one-year anniversary of that failed referendum. How do you see this book and the history you're telling in it within that broader history and that ongoing process of fighting for justice for First Nations people in this country?
Yeah, the timing's been so interesting because I started this book at least a decade ago, well before the Uluru Statement from the Heart, before the idea of a voice to Parliament in its structural form, and certainly before the referendum. In that sense, I mean, all of the books in this trilogy have been politically interventionist to the extent that they are revisionist history. They are directly engaging with national storytelling that has left people out of that equation. First with women at Eureka, women in the Federation story, and then First Nations people as part of the history of democracy in this country. So they are interventionist to that extent. I never imagined that this book would be as political as it is in terms of almost being activist. Mm. Interventionist is one thing, activist is something else. And what it has ended up, I think, becoming, particularly as you say, its publication is on the anniversary of the referendum, is that it very much points a spotlight on that idea of voice and the fact that it was a 60-year anniversary of the Bark petitions in the same year that the referendum was held. So what it does is act as a form of truth-telling, which is an expression that I wouldn't have known about 10 years ago, but has become much more part of our consciousness since the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which is, you know, its voice, treaty, truth. And as a form of truth-telling, what this story tells is a kind of a sad home truth that these requests from First Nations people to be heard are not a modern phenomenon. There is a long history of it. And there's a long history of the polite, diplomatic, very legal, both in this case in terms of Yolngu law and in terms of British law, attempts to change the power dynamic in order to invest the voice of the people with more power. It's kind of been extraordinary to me to see how this book is being taken up. It was launched in Sydney by Megan Davis, who obviously was incredibly central to the voice referendum in the campaign. And she said that she considers this the first book in the post-Uluru Statement era, that it is actually doing what the Uluru Statement is asking to be done in terms of having allies, and in her view, historians are incredibly important allies, to being able to expand the heart of the nation to understand what has happened in the past so that there isn't this sense that this is a kind of flash-in-the-pan grievance, but this is part of a long, long history. And Megan very much considered that understanding this history, that the general population being educated about this history, is part of how there will be change in the future. It's also really struck me, watching the voice referendum play out last year, how many of the arguments against a voice to parliament were so similar to the arguments that were anti-suffrage and anti-minor at the time, against that universal franchise. The idea that the social fabric will come asunder, will rip and tear, the sky will fall. The idea that what was being asked by the people was in some way divisive. I mean, we heard that all the time, didn't we? You know, that was one of Dutton's main lines, that this is going to divide the nation, and it already had, and it had already divided First Nations people. All those same arguments got played out. One of the things that I hope people might get from reading this book, or particularly reading the trilogy, is understanding that what is threatening in the moment from the vantage point of history doesn't seem so threatening anymore. So, you know, there was absolute pandemonium, prophecies of doom about what would happen if you gave women the vote. Now, some people might say those prophecies have come true and that it was all been downhill ever since. But the majority of people, I would say, would consider that it hasn't divided nations, nor wrecked homes, nor stopped women from marrying and having children, because they go to the ballot box once every 3 or 4 years. And I hope in some way that that gives people who are frightened of change, and we know that a lot of people probably voted no because they were intimidated into the idea that if you don't know, vote no. That if you can't foresee the future, if you don't understand what it's going to mean, then block it. I hope people might see from the expanse of this trilogy that these prophecies of doom are recycled from generation to generation. But in the end, the process of democratic expansion is ultimately one that gives us not division, but cohesion.
Claire, in the close of your book, you write that in the past year, you have found and repatriated a missing fourth Bark petition. Can you tell us about this experience and how it came about? And I was wondering what it was like to set the archive straight.
Yeah. One of the things about the Bark petitions, because this is the first time there's been any in-depth historical research done on it, I mean, you'll find a couple of paragraphs about the Bark petitions in any book about land rights or native title or Mabo or general books about First Nations rights. But there hadn't been any deep historical research that was done. One of the things that happens in that vacuum is that a lot of theories or possibilities get circulated, particularly on the internet. And one of them, in regard to the Bark petitions, was how many of them there were. So there's two in Parliament House on display next to the Prime Minister's Gallery. There's one in the National Museum. And there was an idea there might be another one, maybe two, unknown. One of the things that I was able to do in the research was to identify that there were, in fact, four. This was because of this extraordinary archival find that I had in tracking down the son of Reverend Edgar Wells and Anne Wells. Anne was integral to this story. I knew they had a son. I knew what his name was. Doing some old-fashioned archival research, i.e. going through the phone book, helped me find him after cold calling a lot of Jay Wells's. And once I did, I was able to say, do you have any of your parents' materials, records, anything? He said, I've got everything.
Mm.
He said, when Dad died, I just closed the door. There were filing cabinets. This is the eureka moment, you know, to find a trove of documents that no one's ever seen before. And because Anne was a meticulous note keeper and she recorded everything about the creation of the petitions, I was able to discover how many they were, who painted them, who they were sent to, a whole lot of actual just sort of forensic factual detail. And then once knowing there were four, I was able to, through various means, find the person who was in custody of the fourth. And she'd had it since 1963. It had been given to her husband at the time. He was one of the civil rights activists down south who helped the Yolngu in their plight. So there's no question of this being stolen in any way or being nefariously in her possession. But what this woman, once I eventually found her, very generously volunteered to do after we had a discussion about it was to hand the petition back to the Yolngu people. She agreed that it could return to country and she asked me if I could facilitate that, and that's what happened. So a group of Yolngu people and I went to Derby where she lived in Western Australia, so it was a long way from northeast Arnhem Land to Derby and from Melbourne to triangulate that, and a group of conservators from South Australian Museum brought that petition back to South Australia. It was conserved for a year, and then in December last year it was repatriated to country. I think that setting the record straight is one thing, but the most important thing to me is, you know, in academia we would call this impact, real world impact, but actually what that means in real terms is for Yolngu people to have that petition back in Yirrkala. I mean, people up there have said to me, it's like closing the book on this story. It's like healing a wound. And they've told me how important it is to have that document back on country. And so to be able to use my resources as an historian to have facilitated something that is considered to be healing, that's a research highlight that I don't expect ever to repeat again. It's extremely meaningful in a personal sense, which I think transcends just the idea of setting the record straight.
Claire, we're running out of time, but of course we can't let you go before asking our standard Archive Fever closing question, which is, as you know, do you have a little dirty archive secret you're willing to share with us?
Okay. So in episode one of season one, I discussed my dirty little archive secret, and I'm going to give you another one now, which slightly riffs on the theme. This is not one I prepared previously, just the first thing that's just sprung into my mind, is the fact that one of the things that I did after speaking to all the Yolngu people up there and doing the oral history, or yarning is another way of saying that, anything that I used from those interviews and had written into the prose, I took my whole first draft back up to Arnhem Land. It was there for about a month. After that first draft was written, and I sat down with everybody who had participated and given me those words, and I read through those sections where I had used those words. to make sure that I'd gotten it right, that they were happy with the context and the way that I'd used it, whether they wanted to change anything. And that copy of the first draft, it's so fat that it's actually in two volumes, I have sat down with so many people in so much red dirt that it is actually covered in red dirt itself. My dirty little archive secret is that I have created my own archive, which is the first draft of
my
book. Which
is very dirty.
Which is very, very dirty indeed. It's covered in country.
I can just see this in a National Library of Australia file.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's where it'll go sometime.
Very much a challenging conservation project, though.
Now, that's all we have time for today. But thank you so much, Claire, for being a guest here on Archive Fever. You can find out more about Claire's book, Nakul Daruk, as well as her previous works at her website, clairewright.com.au. You can follow her on Twitter at Claire A. Wright and on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian. And you can follow Matt Smith, our fabulous producer and co-host for today, on Twitter at Nightlight Guy.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees.
Don't forget that you can catch up on all five previous seasons of Archive Fever via the website archivefeverpod.com. You can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Matt Smith.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by yours truly on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode...
What I wanted to do when I first started to write these true crime books, because Carnage is my third, is tell the stories of these people, A, in their own words, and B, to try and explain their values as they were supposedly held and actually lived. I've always wondered what bad guys' stories are like from a bad guy's point of view. I mean, we can all, you know, express contempt and repulsion for people who do evil things, but I wanted to know how people who do evil things, I guess, live with them themselves.